Paper 1, Section 6. It's at the bottom there of old single column, page 29. We're just gonna finish up the initial effort they're making here in paper one to get us to challenge ourselves. You know, first paper, the first things they're challenging us to do is to seek as high a recognition of personality as we can. And when we find that, seek something higher. So you'll see they're in that spirit here as we continue on with personality in the universe.
Number 6, personality in the universe. Human personality is the time-space image shadow cast by the divine creator personality. And no actuality can ever be adequately comprehended by an examination of its shadow. Shadows should be interpreted in terms of the true substance.
Okay, just a little paragraph, but this is the bridge from where we were last time. Whenever you hear the whole shadow cast illusion, I mean, we're hearkening back to Plato, a little Platonic idealism, being invoked here between the lines, in contrast to what we had last time. They mentioned materialism, philosophic materialism. The contrasting philosophy is idealism in that sense that Plato put it forward, where you have some notion that if you put it into a real context, you have the notion that spirit substance is the real substance, and material substance is just a shadow of that real substance. With that in mind, now think about what they just did there. Did they say, that thing that Plato had? Yeah, that's true. Spirit is the only real substance, and that matter stuff, you should reject that. He didn't get that. He said, well, the truth of that is not in the substance, but there is a truth when you contemplate personality. Remember, we have two basic types of first source personality, creator personality and creature personality. And so they're giving you a little sense right here that there's a, as you might expect, there's a definite hierarchical relationship between the two. Human personality, creature personality, is the time-space image shadow cast by divine creator personality. So in that sense of thinking about personality, you can put some truth into that old shadow notion that Plato put forward. So that's a very common theme. Lots and lots of places in the book, they point to some the musings of some philosopher in history, and say, well, not quite. If you want to go that route, what you need to think about is personality. That's the thing that you were trying to get your hands on and didn't. Fell short and substituted something else, like substance. Or self. We've talked about that many times. Many times it's self is being cast in the role of personality. That's kind of a fun little between the lines little thing, that they're just slipping in there to contrast for those who are ready to, who can recognize that they just mentioned materialism and what about the opposite of materialism? Now they're going to move on to get to the main point here a little bit more.
Well, I've thought about personality sometimes as being like a puzzle piece taken out of the first source, mm-hmm. And so that where it fits is still there. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of like the reverse of that. It's like what's still there is still there, and what's out in the universe is the shape, but not the substance. Is that
right? I mean, you know, whenever you're working with analogies, you know, they always have their limits. I mean, there's in certain contexts, the puzzle piece notion is, you know, is a very valid one, especially if you're thinking about the purposing that's attached to personality. You have one puzzle piece of the totality of the purposing of infinity. You have one measure, and it's not a an interchangeable part-like measure. It has a very specific, unique place in the entire picture of infinity. So, you know, that the puzzle piece analogy works, you know, quite well there, but it's going to, you know, have issues if you try to use it for everything, understand everything about personality. One of the things that they're pointing out there or alluding to there is you have, you know, the literal personalized deity that is God. That's one thing, you know, creator personality. But you and I, we have something that's related to that, but it's by no means equivalent to that. In no sense should we think of ourselves as being a creator being because we've been given this personality. You see, and that kind of ties into the shadow aspect. I mean, you have potential God-likeness, but not godness. You know, and again, that brings up that reflecting on the difference between deity and divinity. You can be divine, but never deity. The shadow image fits in a little bit to, you know, that relationship between deity and divinity. Another place where you can understand a little bit using that analogy of the shadow. So, it's always very important to really achieve a direct recognition of things using your three cosmic intuitions, you know, with the help of the Spirit of Truth and the Thought Adjuster, you know, achieve a direct recognition and then attempt to understand, you know, then attempt to interpret, recognize, interpret. And that's where analogies come in, is in that second step of the interpretation of it. And it may take several different analogies to fully interpret what you've initially recognized. Because the recognition is a very holistic phenomenon. It's not likely to be fully expressible in some simple little single linear analogy, or linear-like analogy.
Okay. It's a lot more calories for the interpretation.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it can be, 100 times more work to interpret once you recognize even something that seems like just an initial passing recognition. You know, not super profound, but the more you try to understand it, the more you realize it's really quite extensive and has lots of ramifications.
So. Is it break time?
Well, this indicates that the personality pattern has no independent existence apart from its source.
Right. Again, see, challenge yourself to not think of personality as an object, you know, something. You know, it's neither energy nor substance. Or even force, or something like that. I mean, you know, so you have one purposing, you know, and that purposing has this very interesting phenomenon related to it of identification. I'll come to that in a little bit. You know, and that's, it's that identification process where the individuality likeness really starts to come into play. But just because personality has an identification point doesn't mean that it somehow is literally this independent thing, that's been dropped into your head or something. When you start to think about it more precisely, this whole notion of this whole issue of the bestowal of personality, the individuation of will, we talk about it, like that, but you've got to recognize there's where the limits of that, use of language is when you're talking about personality.
Briefly, personality as it's bestowed, everyone has the same personality, but as it's purposed within us, it becomes unique. We give it
no
uniqueness, or we become unique.
You definitely want to think of that. To the extent to which it can take on an independent, measure of the total purposing, that it has a uniqueness to begin with. I'm trying to think. It's a very subtle thing. If anything, it's a measure of kind of the reverse of what you were saying. If you take two identical twins, you have, initially identical selves, and there is going to be, even though you have two absolutely unique personalities that are going to identify with those two selves, there's going to be limits to how much you're going to notice that uniqueness, because the first thing, that's got to be happening is overcoming, the identicalness of the selves. It's actually a good example to think about of how subtle and how limited personality manifestation is in this life. That you can go through a long stretch of years with a pair of identical twins, and there's still a lot of similarities. In other words, not much personality has managed to get through and start to really differentiate the two. Yes, there is a unique way that personality is engaging a given energy system, And even if you have two energy systems that are identical, there's a unique way that each is engaging it. But, if those two, what's going to initially sort of, differentiate, especially if their environmental experiences are very similar, the harmony that personality is producing, it's starting with the same factors, so it's going to have a fairly similar harmony, at this initial crude level of expression. See, so you have this tendency in that situation to have a hard time understanding what personality is, because it seems like everything is self. There's no differential. Even though there might be some personality, it's kind of so far at this initial level, it's kind of the same in each, and so you can't distinguish it between the identicalness of the selves. And then on the other side, if you take two very different selves, the difference of the selves is such a dominant differential between the two that the subtleness of the personality in play is kind of lost. See, so you got to think about it very carefully.
When I think about personality, I think about puzzle pieces, but then I also think about patterns, as in, making jacket patterns and dress patterns. And so I think, developing the color of our fabric and the texture of our fabric and, our personal talents and just living life and developing what we've been given, I think is a start. But yeah, that kind of explains why it doesn't usually kick in very quickly.
Right. Just not to belabor the sandals here, but just, like they point out, a lot of the opportunity for personality to manifest isn't even in place until you get to Havona. Like you're pointing out, you want to take a very long-term view on this. You're trying to manifest the essence that transcends, almost everything else in reality. You're going to have to do a lot of prep work to get to the point where there's even the opportunity to express very much of something that's so high, and sort of rarefied in nature.
Yeah. I was reading something, and I wish I could recall it, but I can't. But it lent gravity to your pattern of personality coming from the Father and the thought adjuster coming from the Universal Mother. And that it was...
The thought adjuster doesn't come from the Universal Mother.
Well, it has more of the character of the Mother.
The experiential aspect wrapped around it is... Okay. Is motherly.
Yeah. But the Father, this passage I was reading, it seemed like the Father was an existential point coming from, the personality was almost like an existential point, within the time-space. It was more of a direct connection to the Father, than the thought adjuster, whereas the thought adjuster had more experience associated with it.
Yes, yeah, right. The personality, is always very directly an initiating influence. Because it's not a thing, it's not like it can accumulate anything onto its thingness. It's not a thing. So it's not like a snowball rolling through anything and growing in any way. It's changeless. It's just this existential initiating influence, that's attempting to initiate harmony in the system, and that influence is changeless. It's eternal. It's existential, like. See. All right.
God is to science a cause, to philosophy an idea, to religion a person. Even the loving Heavenly Father. God is to the scientist a primal force, to the philosopher a hypothesis of unity, to the religionist a living spiritual experience. Man's inadequate concept of the personality of the Universal Father can be improved only by man's spiritual progress in the universe, and will become truly adequate only when the pilgrims of time and space finally attain the divine embrace of the living God on paradise.
See, that's related to what I was just saying. They're taking it all the way to paradise there, not even Havona, but all the way. Just always be challenging yourself to have a higher concept of personality tomorrow than you do today. And you're always still an infinite distance away from the full actuality of it. But one little thing I wanted to just point out there that's kind of fun, when they bring up the scientist, the philosopher, and the religionist there, if you take what they're invoking in those three little clauses there, There's in the book, they have three hyphenated, compound words that they construct, where the first one is Father, capital F, Father hyphen, and those three different ones are taking what you're invoking here in each of these three clauses all the way to its limits. With that, God is to the scientist a primal force. The expression for that complete idea there is the Father force. I use that term, the Father force, capital F, Father, capital F, force, hyphenated. Mm-hmm. The Father force. That's what you're shooting towards there. Mm-hmm. When they use the expression, the Father I am, okay, that's to the philosopher a hypothesis of unity. You take that all the way to the end point, and the expression for where you're aiming for there as a philosopher is the concept expressed by the Father I am. And then for the religionist, that full concept that you're shooting toward is the Father infinite. So those three hyphenated expressions they use are tied to those three: the Father force, the Father I am, the Father infinite. It's just something that when you run across those and you're reading in other places, see if you can remember to come back and reflect on. Okay, you can the Father force, for instance, you could think as being tied to. The fact of his unindividuated personality power. And the Father I am, for instance, you could think of as being tied to his unindividuated spirit energy. Again, using two hyphenated words in both of those. And we talked a little bit about the notion of the Father infinite, taking the idea of taking the concept of the Father and extending your recognition of it all the way around to its root. The Universal Father, the Father Absolute, the Father Infinite. Just wanted to bring that up as a little side note there.
What was the third one?
Father Infinite. Father Force, Father I Am, Father Infinite. Capital I, Father Infinite, like they introduced in the foreword.
Back to this first sentence.
Mm-hmm.
God is to science a cause,
mm-hmm.
to philosophy an idea.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious why they didn't use the word ideal.
No, not ideal, idea.
I know, but why didn't they use the word ideal?
Because that's a religious word. Yeah.
Ideal is a religious word?
Yeah. Yeah, idea is a spirit word. Ideal is a spirit word. Religion is a system of ideals.
But they're talking about God, so why wouldn't it be spiritual?
We're talking about the full picture. An idea is only constructed when you add reflection, which only a personality can do, when you add reflection to your sensory inputs. You get these inputs, and then you reflect on them and form an idea relative to them. Okay, so all these, we're going to read a little bit more. Let's not belabor this too much until we read the rest of it. But you'll see what they're trying to get at. They're trying to get you to think of an idea as a lot bigger than you've ever thought of it as being. Especially when you go, well, ideas, I don't care about ideas. I'm about ideals. You think you're doing that because you're throwing out material things in favor of spiritual things. Well, ideas are spiritual too. You only can have an idea because of the Holy Spirit. In any genuine sense of the word idea. So that's one of the things they're getting at. I'll point out what I mean by that as we read a little bit more here.
Never lose sight of the antipodal viewpoints of personality as it is conceived by man and by God and man. Man views and comprehends personality, looking from the finite to the infinite. God looks from the infinite to the finite. Man possesses the lowest type of personality. God, the highest, even supreme, ultimate, and absolute. Therefore, did the better concepts of the divine personality have patiently to await the appearance of improved ideas of human personality, especially the enhanced revelation of both human and divine personality in the Urantian bestowal life of Michael, the Creator's Son.
Two little things just to make sure you take away from that. The first part, notice how they're, never lose sight. I mean, very strong, and it's this bidirectional viewpoint picture, that they're invoking again. If me stressing it all the time hasn't been enough, notice how strong the divine counselor is. Never lose sight. If you're going to understand anything, you can't ever lose sight of both viewpoints at the same time. You need both the time viewpoint and the eternity viewpoint. You need both the individuality viewpoint and the unity viewpoint. You need bottom up and top down in order to have any true understanding of who you are, how the universe is set up, how God relates to you. That's just a very, very new idea. That's being put forward in the revelation, that trying to get us to, have in just everywhere you can think of having both eyes open. Not one eye that's trying to be both eyes. Either a material viewpoint that's trying to be extrapolated into everything else, or a spirit viewpoint that's trying to be extrapolated into everything else. Have a true viewpoint, and so now you can see why they stuck that little tiny paragraph at the beginning of this, that little bit about, and you know that thing about how you've always had this tendency to create a dichotomy between matter and spirit. Okay, there is no such fact. The aisle and the sun are on the same absolute plane. If you're going to look for a hierarchical relationship, don't look to matter and spirit, in any sort of absolute sense. Look to creator personality and creature personality, it creates this fundamental downreach from creator personality, initiating an upflow of creature personality. That's the fundamental thing that's going on.
Didn't Jesus use that as the gospel?
What?
The fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of men?
Yes. You're right. You can appreciate that a little bit more as part of this bidirectional phenomenon. You can't just have the brotherhood of man as an initial planar response to that initiation from the fatherhoodness of God. you have to begin to be drawn up. One must do something as well as be something. You have to begin to actually be an ascending phenomenon in order for there to actually be a brotherhood of man. This kindred spirit thing is just the potentializing, and nothing's moved yet. The kindred minds, that's when things are moving upward, and that's the brotherhood of man. And the extent to which someone who overemphasizes their spiritual viewpoint believes that kindred minds that's impossible, how much success are they going to have in actualizing the brotherhood of man, no matter how much they desire it? The kindred spirit fact is not the brotherhood of man. That's the potential for the brotherhood of man. It doesn't matter how much kindred spirit you have. It's still just the potential for the brotherhood of man. Yeah. So, again, it reminds you of, we've got a universal bestowal of thought adjusters because of the spiritual uplifter who came 2,000 years ago. The potential is fully there. I mean, who thinks that they can add to what the adjuster, gives Chris or Don, spiritually? I mean, do I really think that I can somehow spiritually uplift transcendent of what the adjuster is always already doing for Don? I don't think so. Don doesn't need any more potentializing. Sydney doesn't need any more potentializing.
If ever there was an exception.
It's just very important to recognize that, because it's an extremely common mistake that spiritual thinkers make, that, because they don't see the brotherhood of man, we're lacking spirit. No. You're lacking spirit being woven in to fact. That's what you're lacking. The brotherhood of man is the kindred mind of bringing the matter and the spirit together. Not the absence of spirit. And it's not, wanting because of the absence of spirit. So this is, I stress this over and over because it is fundamentally what the revelators are trying to do in as a fifth epical revelation. Now that you have recognized that you have a spirit nature, because Michael saw to it that you have a hard time missing it now. You've got to really, be tone deaf. And if someone is tone deaf, I mean, you can pour all the spirit on them you want. They're still tone deaf. Nothing's going to happen. Okay. That's just the facts. But, if you aren't totally tone deaf and the spirit being poured out, literally poured, that's what I was using, that, poured out upon all flesh, you've got that. So now what? That's what the revelation is all about. Yep.
So I was reading the first page, up at the top, God is to science a cause, to philosophy an idea, mm-hmm. to religion a person. The to philosophy an idea. I was looking at those and I was thinking, okay, now how do those relate to personality and why are they telling us this? Then we just got to this last sentence, and they talk about, therefore did the better concepts of the divine personality, or therefore did the better concepts of the divine personality have patiently to await the appearance of improved ideas, there's that idea word again, of human personality, and then especially the enhanced revelation of, and so on. I think that they're implying as we develop our philosophy better, and that's going to help us improve and weave, like you were just talking about, them together. I think philosophy is the key here.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to talk about that next. That's the other part of this thing that, that I didn't want you to leave without, carefully noticing. And you basically already put the primary thing to notice out there. And that's, I was going to tell you, we were quickly going to get to something that would relate to that. Without philosophy, you don't have genuine ideas. And without genuine ideas about personality, you basically have got nothing. See how they're wording that? You know, and this is, again, back what I said right when we started reading tonight. You cannot spend too much effort in trying to advance your ideas of personality. Okay? Just like they're saying there, they have to patiently await. There's all of the God downreach that any human could ever handle already in place. Okay, but it is basically impotent. It can't do squat because humans have such a primitive notion of what they are as a personality. Hence, they are not really manifesting much personality. And that's all that God can engage. God is not trying to engage your material mind. God's trying to engage you as a person. You see, so just think about that again. To take it beyond, it says, therefore did the better concepts of divine personality have to await the appearance of improved ideas and personality. Okay, just, you understanding the nature of God is going to be limited by your limited understanding of what you are as a person. Or like they were mentioning in the first paragraph, that whole image shadow thing. But, there's a literalness behind that as well. Once you get a higher concept of God as a person, you have a greater recognition of how limited God's ability to engage you is when you are not really functioning in a personal way. Okay. So, that's sort of what's between the lines of that statement, that this is a very important thing to challenge yourself to work on. Okay, there was something over here, was it? Yeah.
But God is limited in how he can engage you that way. But just to soften that, remember, mom's coming around the other side and she's holding you while you're limited.
Yeah, but we're about to talk about that, and there's the limitation there too.
Well, the image I have in my mind is on the back of the $1 bill made by Benjamin Franklin, and he used an eye at the top of the pyramid, which would God have an eye, or at least Benjamin would recognize that God was a personality, or is.
Great. You have a comment on that?
Well, I got a comment on Katie's, but then he made me think of something real quick. Okay. Benjamin Franklin may have been trying to depict the eye of awareness of the personality within the self. I don't know.
I mean,
how strong of a deist he was.
There's an insight, yeah. Sort of that's being invoked by that image, the notion of insight.
You mentioned something that kind of dovetails on Katie's comment that I caught. You said that God engages the personality, he doesn't engage the mind, but I was thinking, well, the Supreme engages. Does the Supreme engage the mind?
Don't oversimplify what I say. God is engaging the harmony of you, which is partly in your mind. It's a full matter, mind, spirit harmony. He's engaging that.
When you say God, you mean the complete God, not just God the Father.
Right. I mean God the Father and God the Mother. God, personalized deity. Personality can only engage personality. Doesn't matter if it's God the Mother or God the Father. It's God.
Is the spear point for that harmony.
I mean, you've got to have like to match like. Okay, let's get a little more here.
The pre-personal divine spirit which indwells the mortal mind carries, in its very presence, the valid proof of its actual existence. But the concept of the divine personality can be grasped only by the spiritual insight of genuine personal religious experience. Any person, human or divine, may be known and comprehended quite apart from the external reactions or the material presence of that person.
Now, let's not try to endlessly talk about this. Just reflect on that. Just reflect on that sentence. Let it dwell in your mind what they're telling you there. Think about that last little bit. Any person, human or divine, may be known and comprehended quite apart from the external reactions or the material presence of that person. We're talking about personality, okay, recognition. If you start thinking about what do I think personality is, if what you're thinking of can be described as external reactions or something about the material presence, that's not personality. And notice how strongly, quite apart from, okay? We're talking about something that's independent of that. The only way that you can get at personality is with insight. Okay, and if it's sad to record that so few persons have developed very much insight, how much do you think that humans know about the actuality of personality? Right. It's not a sight phenomenon. It's an insight phenomenon. So that's a really great example, or a direct sentence, of what I've said so many times. Just listen to what some human says about personality, what they think personality is, and their whole system of personality types or something like that. It's about this stuff. It's not about personality.
So if we have our Marantia bodies and we look totally different than we do now, we sound totally different, is it partly the essence that people recognize you by?
You still have to have insight into that Marantia expression. There's much less of a casing around yourself when you have a Marantia form. So the self is very visible. But the personality is still only perceivable when you see into that self.
So it's beyond that even. Yeah. There.
Yeah.
So it's more...
Even
it's going to be way longer before you're showing it up much, showing much of what your pattern.
It's always something that you perceive by insight, not by sight. Even when you have a spirit body, it's still true. Mm-hmm. You have matter, mind, spirit. Personality is above all that. Okay. Doesn't matter if you take it all the way to spirit. Even if you think of matter, mind, spirit in some hierarchy thing, personality is still above that spirit. Okay? It's always transcendent of what's immediately seen. It's what's within what's seen. Yeah.
To me, that explains why some psychically advanced people can know people at a distance without having met them.
If I'm psychically advanced, quote unquote, I have extended mindal abilities and I can engage your mindal self from a distance or something like that or perceive. It's not personality. It's mind. See, again, it's not personality. It's not even spirit. It's mind. Okay? I just want to keep stressing this. There's nothing that you can think of that points to this. If there was, we wouldn't have all this revelation about the personality. We'd all understand this. This is something that humans have not understood. All humans have is exaltations of that which is lesser. Not only relative to personality, but even relative to spirit. We've talked about this many times. Most people, when they, that's a very spiritual phenomenon. No, that's a mindal phenomenon. They haven't even figured out the difference between mind and spirit. let alone spirit and personality, and self and personality. Okay. That's why I say, just keep challenging yourself to go further and further than anything that any human has ever thought about attached to that word. That's what you're after. It's very much a phenomenon of truth. It's something that you seek, not something that you find. Okay? Personality is something you seek. But you can recognize, see, with your insight, that there is such a thing, even though you'll be seeking it forever. You know, it's always going to be, it's always going to require insight, not just direct sight, no matter how fancy your sight becomes, you know, a trillion years from now. Okay.
Some degree of moral affinity and spiritual harmony is essential to friendship between two persons. A loving personality can hardly reveal himself to a loveless person. Even to approach the knowing of a divine personality, all of man's personality endowments must be wholly consecrated to the effort. Half-hearted, partial devotion will be unavailing.
Okay. You know, and you see moral affinity, and then you see spiritually, and you're starting to think, oh, second cosmic intuition, third cosmic intuition. But there's harmonies in there. I mean, they're really invoking all three there, the harmony of the threefold actuality. And this whole bit about heart, see, the word heart is there. Okay, we now know what they mean when they use the word heart. They mean that domain that the Holy Spirit creates, that has volume because there's three intuitions that establish three levels. Give that domain volume, you know, spread it out of a plane. There's that domain that is your heart, okay? And you can't use half of that domain to achieve this. Even to approach the knowing of a divine personality, all of man's personality endowments must be wholly consecrated, the second consecration, to the effort, okay? You have to have consecrated your mind to the universal harmony, you know, the cosmos. Okay, so you're not going to get it with just your spiritual insight and your moral discrimination. There has to be full logical acumen working as well. Now, and just think about that. You've got those three levels up there in the heart. How could I split that into two different types of half-heartedness? Okay? I could be working on my logical acumen and the side of the moral discrimination that faces the logical acumen. That's half the heart. Or I could be working on my spiritual insight and the side of the moral discrimination that faces the spiritual insight. That's half the heart. There's lots of half-hearted people, okay, that at least they're not no-hearted. I mean, at least they're not just, you know, fancy animals down here with really no relationship to what's going on in the upper domain of their nature. But there's a strong tendency, even when you begin to have a little bit more going on, to be half-hearted. You know, too heavenly minded, you're no earthly good, or too earthly minded, you're no heavenly good. Those are half-hearted, you know, expressions. Wholehearted. You have to be just as strongly, genuinely logical. Again, not some false notion of the word logic. Genuinely logical as you are spiritual. Truly spiritual. If you're going to succeed in being a person or connecting with any other person, including God. You can't connect to God half as a half-hearted phenomenon, because God is fundamentally wholehearted in nature. If you're half-hearted, the two of you don't meet. There's no relationship, no true relationship. You want to? Okay.
Well, it's on effort. It sounds that man's personality and down must be wholly consecrated to fully doing,
mm-hmm.
completely doing.
I mean, again, this just the consecration. See, is the key there. I mean, that's the doingness that's in play. Again, it's that difference. You know, one must do something as well as be something. There's two consecrations. You consecrate your will to the perfect will of God the Father. That now you are. That's the being. But the consecration of your mind. To the cosmic harmony, that's a doing phenomenon. There's just nothing fiat about it. It's doing, always doing, and not just partly doing, wholly doing. You know, you have to get your whole self into play. You know, it has to be a consecration.
Yeah. Well, this. I see this as relating directly to the mandate to in worship to mm-hmm. My will be done, your will.
Well, it is my will that your will be done. Well, that's a consecration. See, that's yeah, right.
Exactly. To me, that is consecration, and that's why that is so important that we consecrate ourselves to the finding and doing.
And not only am I not interested in what my will could be independent of the Father's will, I'm not interested in what my mind can think separate from the harmony of the cosmos. I have no interest in what that mind can do independent of the cosmos. You know? I want to have a mind that conforms to the cosmos, and I can't just snap my fingers and have just that. I've got all this mind that doesn't conform to the cosmos still, but it's just there. It does not intrigue me at all, you know, and that's frustrating to the world because the world loves to make appeals to those little parts of my mind that aren't conformable to the cosmos and wants me to get all fixated and wrapped up in something and spend, you know, at least a whole day, if not, you know, the next year, you know, chasing my tail about something. Okay? If I don't care about what that, you know, mind's subjective tendencies are, I've just completely taken their power away. They have no power over me anymore, because I don't care about that part of my mind that's subject to their influence. Yeah. And not only that, I can expose myself to what's going on and I don't become subject to it. So I can actually know what's going on, think about it objectively, feed that into my, you know, into my nature, but it doesn't consume me in any way. I'm the master of it.
Yeah. Now, here's a double-edged sword. How about, how do I approach the idea of father-onlyists and how they would say, oh, are you calling me a half-hearted person then because I don't accept God the Mother? Now can you hit me up on that one and straighten me out?
If someone hasn't gotten to the point yet where the fact of God the Mother is self-evident, then don't worry about it. The Father hasn't fully initiated them yet. Let the Father finish his initiation process with them first. You know, there's nothing you can say or do that's going to somehow be a more effective initiator within them than the Father. Okay, they're being initiated as fast as they can be initiated. Man cannot cause growth. Okay, so don't try to grow them. Recognize where they are. If they're still being initiated, well, love them as they are. But for those who have gotten to the point where they're ready to recognize what happens after you are, you know, that genuine doing, okay, you know, then you can help them to move into that new phase of their life, that new phase of their ascension career. All right, let's read some more here.
The more completely man understands himself and appreciates the personality values of his fellows, the more he will crave to know the original personality. And the more earnestly such a God-knowing human will strive to become like the original personality. You can argue over opinions about God, but experience with him and in him exists above and beyond all human controversy in mere intellectual logic. The God-knowing man describes his spiritual experiences, not to convince unbelievers, but for the edification and mutual satisfaction of believers.
See, that last sentence is a little bit like what I was just talking about in the answer to your question there. Just one little thing I want you to note there, because I kind of mentioned it in passing a minute ago. Notice their phrasing there, mere intellectual logic. Okay, you know, people use the word logic, including very smart people, as a word that indicates that that in your reasoning you have used what they see as the correct initial assumptions. And therefore, they call your thinking logical. Okay, and to a degree, okay, I mean that is the way it works. I mean, you have to have some sort of initial assumptions. Okay, and if you're staying tied properly to those initial assumptions, that you have a mere intellectual logic in play. But the challenge is to not judge it by the shadow. That's a shadow again. There's genuine logic. There's true logic that exists as an objective fact, and you have you've been given a gift to engage that, and that's what you want to challenge yourself to have. You want to have initial assumptions that conform to the cosmos. And how do you know if they do? Well, your reality response, your logical acumen, will give you that feeling of resonance. You'll get a reality response from it. That's why they're not just mere reasoning that starts with some widely accepted initial assumption, and so it's called logical. Yeah. They're very careful about giving you verbiage that is trying to get you to recognize, a more objective picture on these things. Okay. This is a very important paragraph in the book. That's why it's set off by big divisions here, see?
To assume that the universe can be known, that it is intelligible, is to assume that the universe is mind-made and personality-managed. Man's mind can only perceive the mind phenomena of other minds, be they human or superhuman. If man's personality can experience the universe, there is a divine mind and an actual personality somewhere concealed in that universe.
Okay. The word science means knowledge. Yeah. True science is true knowledge, not some goofy notion that science is data collecting and data analysis and elaborate rationalization schemes or whatever. Okay, we're talking about true science, a science that everyone who's going to have a relationship with God has to have. Okay, and this is the fundamental assumption of that true science. To assume that the universe can be known, that's the fundamental assumption of the scientific endeavor, that it is intelligible, is to assume that the universe is mind-made and personality-managed. The notion of science is utterly illogical without God. There is no such thing by definition without God. Okay? Because the fundamental assumption of science is the assumption that there's a God who has made and is personally managing the universe. That's why it's knowable. It's knowable. That's how there can be a scientist. Okay? Without God, there isn't a scientist. So there is no science. Okay? And then it's very literal, like you're trying to point out in the rest of that. The knowing is in your mind. It's not in your atoms, your molecules, or the collection of molecules. It's in your mind energy. So the extent to which you're not deaf, dumb, and blind, mindily, that you actually experience otherness mindily, that means that there's mind out there, because mind can only be interacting with other mind. So to think of it in just material terms, let's see, isn't it coming up here very soon? They use the term interaction here. This is an interaction, a material interaction between my hand and this wood. Okay, but that's, to recognize that the scientist is doing something way beyond interacting matter to matter. There's a mind-mind interaction. It's where the knowingness is coming in. And then even beyond that, if there is some sort of spirit consciousness, there has to be spirit out there. If your spirit consciousness is not deaf, dumb, and blind, if it sees something, there has to be spirit out there, or it would see nothing. And then the highest of all, if your personality consciousness sees something, there has to be personality out there, or it would be deaf, dumb, and blind. There would be no interaction phenomenon. All right, so you see again, and that's a logical appeal. That sentence can only ring true if you have a relationship to the first cosmic intuition. You can't, or another way to look at it, you can't initiate science without the first cosmic intuition. That recognition is what initiates the scientific endeavor. You know that the universe can be known. It's like, well, how do you know that? Well, it's self-evident, isn't it? It is to me, isn't it? It isn't to you? Universe is mind made and personality managed. I know that. So I know the universe is inherently logical. Hence it can be known. That's just a given.
So why would you pursue science if you think that it can't be known?
Especially now that you've really definitively codified that notion that fundamentally the universe is not knowable. So what the heck is science then? It's a game. It's just a mind game.
Can I know that you enjoy study group?
Yeah, that would be self-evident. Well, usually I think. All right. So that last little bit here.
God is spirit. Spirit personality. Man is also a spirit. Potential spirit personality. Jesus of Nazareth attained the full realization of this potential of spirit personality in human experience. Therefore, his life of achieving the Father's will becomes man's most real and ideal revelation of the personality of God. Even though the personality of the Universal Father can be grasped only in actual religious experience, in Jesus' earth life, we are inspired by the perfect demonstration of such a realization and revelation of the personality of God in a truly human experience.
Okay, so, you know, again, they're pointing again to why, you know, you should spend the time in careful study of part four. Of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. And now carefully notice, twice in that sentence I just read, a sentence that almost everyone knows, was a word that's up in this matter block, individuality block. Of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value is to know. Okay? You need to engage Jesus' life as a true scientist. That's what that sentence is telling you. Not as a material rationalizer, okay, as a true scientist, someone who has a relationship with knowledge, of all human knowledge, that which is the greatest value is to know. And look at that. In order to get the value that you seek, knowing this is essential. There has to be a relationship to ideas, to knowing.
And how do you do that? You go up to that paragraph. I was kind of wondering how that fit in. The one I brought up before.
This guide is the science of cause, philosophy, and idea. You mean that, or
that and then that's the start.
Oh, and then the follow on to that.
Yeah, follow on.
Therefore,
appearance of improved ideas, human personality, especially the enhanced revelation of both human and divine personality in the Urantian bestowal life of Michael, the Creator's Son. Well, this pulls that through again. So it sounds to me like we need to get the true logic of science, but then we need to use true philosophy as a philosopher, true philosopher, in order and apply that to Jesus' actual demonstration of his religious experience, the living action. So it just kind of all goes together. It makes this make sense up over here.
Right, the whole point is this, you know. You want a harmonious relationship with everything, including Jesus' life and all the other things that you can think of. You know, there has to be a threefold actuality in play in order to achieve that. You can't get what they want you to get out of part four of this book with just your spiritual insight. Half-hearted effort. I'll fall short. I mean, if you're only going to be successful in acquiring that of all human knowledge, that which is of greatest value, if you can do it wholeheartedly, you know, and if you haven't taken delight in cultivating anything except your initial relationship to the first cosmic intuition, it's not going to happen. That's what they're trying to get you to recognize. It's like, okay, maybe I should back off a little on the zeal and see if I can patiently develop some abilities here. You know, these potentials that have been given to me. I need more skill than I have right now, what they're trying to tell me. If I'm going to have a greater relationship with the life and teachings of Jesus or with God, I need to work on this a little bit. Yeah?
To really know the destiny of our planet and the universe, we have to know the mind of Michael, really. You know, we have to come into a relationship there with the Spirit of Truth as that unfolds for the universe.
And rather than to know, to discover, because we need to discover the destiny. It's not revealed what the destiny is.
I mean, you recognize that there is a destiny. I mean, a lot of people don't recognize that their life has a destiny, and anything has a destiny, anything has a purpose. You know, their fundamental assumption may be that there is no purpose, you know, there is no value,
or their purpose, you know,
there is no meaning.
Could be that the highest purpose is the development of a family, or the highest purpose is the development of a tribe, or the highest purpose is even the development of a country. And those are all good in and of themselves, but know, there has to be somebody on the planet that sees the highest purpose beyond, you know, including those things, but also the next step beyond.
Yeah. Things will have to patiently await higher recognition. See? You know, it's not like somehow if you don't have the highest recognition possible, you know, you're done. It's just don't expect things to be moving much. If everyone has sort of the lowest recognition possible, if we want things to start moving, we have to all challenge ourselves to have a higher recognition than we currently have. Or the whole universe is patiently awaiting us to be less than the minimum. You know, the spirit of truth, like you're just saying, is almost wholly limited by your activation of it. You know, you being receptive to it. It can't somehow, it doesn't magically go in and make you receptive and then start giving you something. You know, it patiently waits for you to choose to be something that it can engage. And if you're not making that choice, then it sits there and twiddles a thumb.
Guess what else is unmoving besides
Amazon? Okay, did you want to do this next section?
Spiritual value of the personality concept. When Jesus talked about the living God, he referred to a personal deity, the Father in heaven. The concept of the personality of deity facilitates fellowship. It favors intelligent worship. It promotes refreshing trustfulness. Interactions can be had between non-personal things, but not fellowship. The fellowship relation of Father and Son, as between God and man, cannot be enjoyed unless both are persons. Only personalities can commune with each other, albeit this personal communion may be greatly facilitated by the presence of just such an impersonal entity as the thought adjuster.
Okay, so see, I was pointing to that. A couple things there. There's the interactions. I knew it was coming up here shortly. Okay, so, yeah, you can have interactions, energy interactions between non-personal things. But nothing greater, you know, like fellowship. You know, and just look carefully, you know, like between God and man cannot be enjoyed unless both are persons. You know, they're using the word man, but, you know, may not be much of a personal aspect to that fancy animal that you're calling a man. You know, again, you know, they're just trying to stress what I was just saying. You know, there's no amount of wishful thinking that's going to change this fact that they're stating here. Only personalities can commune with each other. Okay, and we know that in order for you know, two personalities to commune with each other, you do that through the individuality of the whole, through the God the Mother. God the Mother, personalized deity, is the linkage. Well, if you're not functioning as a person, you're not going to be able to use a personalized deity to link you together. The best you can do is kick each other, you know? Kick each other, interact materially, you know? You know, or you could try to develop some sort of, you know, woo-woo mindal phenomenon where the two of you could interact mindally. Okay, but so what? Okay, now you're just an all the fancier animal interacting with another fancy animal. That doesn't get you anywhere. Personal is what you're looking for. Yeah.
So, you know, where Jesus said something like, "Where your mind falls short, use mine."
If you have the ability, if you haven't taken delight in cultivating a relationship with the Spirit of Truth.
So how does that work with the Universal Mother? I mean, the Mother, though, I mean, she's, we're borrowing her mind, too, right?
Right, like I said, I mean, in order for there to be some basic phenomenon going on, the Mother gives you an initial encirclement in the Holy Spirit by grace. But it's the smallest amount that can be given to get the process going, and not one measure more. Everything beyond that, that basic amount that, that the process needs to get initiated. You know, there has to be a little space for the father to initiate something in. So the mother makes the smallest space possible and the father initiates, and that's all you've got by grace. Anything beyond that has to be chosen. You're started by grace. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that we are endowed with our Creator. We know we have a Creator, i.e., God gives us an initiation by grace. Okay, that's what He created in you. He and she, we now recognize it's a joint phenomenon. God the Father and God the Mother are both, involved in that. But that's it. And so now the mother part, that's that last little bit. Albeit this personal communion may be greatly facilitated by the presence of just such an impersonal entity as a thought adjuster. Why? Because, now we understand that. I'm linked to another person via the individuality of the whole, via God the Mother. They're saying that the adjuster is going to catalyze that phenomenon, that linkage. Well, that means there has to be some sort of mother-likeness to that adjuster, or it wouldn't have any relationship to that mother-like linkage. That's that experiential nature that's wrapped around the existential core. The more experience an adjuster has, the better they are at facilitating this. Okay? The more mother-likeness that they've acquired, the more they can do what they're pointing out here. A virgin adjuster is not going to be able to help much with this.
That's an advanced.
And so why do they give virgin adjusters the beings they get? They give virgin adjusters the beings that really aren't at the level where there's going to be anything significant of a personal phenomenon going on in the first place. So, they're just fancy animals getting started. Most of what's going to happen is happening on the first mansion world and beyond. They may be, like for instance, virgin adjusters are coming to primitive humans. It means that humans that are still in that technical state of being primitive, where by and large, they aren't even in father fuser mode. They're just spirit fusers. So all that adjuster is there for is to give make a little embryonic soul. There's just not much that's going to be happening in the life, and the adjuster leaves. It's not going to be able to do this more advanced stuff. So it doesn't. That's why a virgin adjuster can do that job. Yeah, Jason.
It says right up here that the last sentence: only personalities can commune with each other. So. I'm not able to commune with my thought adjuster yet, or am I missing the point again?
The fundamental point of interaction between you and the adjuster is the mind. The adjuster is in your mind. The adjuster has a nature that can directly engage mind. Why? We talked about that here just last week or the week before. The adjuster is a fragment of the infinite upholder. From the individuality viewpoint, the infinite upholder is the universal absolute, the reservoir for mind energy. They're coming from the same place, the mind that it's engaging and it. It's just one that's coming, the mind is coming from the individuality viewpoint and the adjuster is coming from the unity viewpoint. So that's why they fundamentally the adjuster can engage your mind. It has that nature. See, so it's not a personal engagement or even a spirit engagement. Technically, it's a mind-like engagement. It's in your mind. It's not in the spirit above, your mind. It's in your mind because that's what it's like. And the more mother-likeness it has wrapped around that existential core, the more its mind-like existential nature has been downstepped to your where you are, and hence the more effectively it can engage you. I mean, it can be in your mind even as a version adjuster, but you know, it's in the highest aspect of your mind. The more experience it has, the more it can bring that down in to where, you know, it's likely to be more accessible to you. Again, you know, the version adjusters come to the primitives that don't need that sort of intimate engagement. So they're, you know, it's all just up in the most upper reaches of the mind that version adjuster is engaging him. That's all that's required. You can make a little embryonic soul, and that's it. You know, but if it's going to go beyond that, you know, if there's, you know, any hope of getting to like thought controller stage or something, you know, or to the point of fusion, I mean, it's got to come all the way down fully into, you know, to intimate engagement, you know, where you are. All right.
Man does not achieve union with God as a drop of water might find unity with the ocean. Man attains divine union by progressive, reciprocal, spiritual communion, by personality intercourse with the personal God, by increasingly attaining the divine nature through wholehearted and intelligent conformity to the divine will. Such a sublime relationship can exist only between personalities.
Again, reciprocal, as above, so below. You have to make yourself as above, so below. Wholehearted, intelligent conformity. You know, this is, again, it's the consecration of mind. Okay? The wholehearted consecration of your mind, so that, you know, your mind is a significant harmony system. That adjuster is by nature a point of divine harmony in your mind. The two have more and more relationship. Okay, you know, so and then just the, you know, the stuff they're talking about directly there, the personality aspect of, you know, is the main point. But we got off on this adjuster thing a lot. I want to make sure you see how that fits in here too. But again, just stressing that personality intercourse is an illusion for most because it's sad to record. You know, it's just wishful thinking that there's some sort of vast personal phenomenon on this planet. There is not. You know, and that's not bad. We have all the potential.
It rhymes with bad.
It's sad, yes.
This paragraph has a very positive and direct message for us.
Yep.
Man attains divine union by progressive, reciprocal, spiritual communion.
Right.
By personality intercourse with a personal God. And, you know, that's such a direct...
It's a glorious, gospel. It's the good news. There's no doubt about it, but it's not magic good news. You know, the difficult part is I have to actually do something. It's not just automatic. You know, can I just be in full wholehearted communion automatically? No. God would love you to be in greater communion, but it's going to take some effort on your part. One must do something as well as be something.
The concept of truth might possibly be entertained apart from personality. The concept of beauty may exist without personality, but the concept of divine goodness is understandable only in relation to personality. Only a person can love and be loved. Even beauty and truth would be divorced from survival hope if they were not attributes of a personal God, a loving Father. We cannot fully understand how God can be primal, changeless, all-powerful and perfect, and at the same time be surrounded by an ever-changing and apparently law-limited universe, an evolving universe of relative imperfections. But we can know such a truth in our own personal experience, since we all maintain identity of personality and unity of will, in spite of the constant changing of both ourselves and our environment.
So there's it. See, that's a little. See, there's challenging you to step back and reflect a minute. It's like, wait a minute, maybe I do have a recognition that I hadn't thought about. Maybe I do actually know that. See, but again, it's It's only if you step back and use that your ability to have a subtle recognition of things from that objective vantage point that you'll notice, maybe it's not as bad as I thought. You know, it may be sad to record, but if I step back and just notice, I do have that initial thing. I can recognize that, at least in retrospect now, that, you know, I've maintained an identity of personality and unity of will in spite of the constant changing of myself and the environment around me. Yeah, everyone, you know, talks about that. You know, I still kind of think of myself the same way I did when I was a kid. Okay? That's that very subtle little thing. And it's just sort of a self-recognition. It hasn't really manifested much of anything. It's just a self-recognition that you can notice is there and has always been there as far back as you can remember. There's this constant.
It's initial.
That's that initial little personal nature that can recognize that. Now, blow on that a little bit. See if you can develop that a little bit more. Instead of it being just something that you occasionally pause and, you know, and say, you know, I kind of feel like, you know, I feel that I think of myself the same way as I did when I was 10. It's like, well, okay, that's wonderful, but, you know, can we do something more than just that, you know? So that's what they're getting at. Take delight in cultivating, going beyond that initial encirclement that can give you a recognition like that.
In spite of the constant changing on both ourselves and the environment.
Right.
In spite
of it, right. Because it transcends matter, mind, and spirit, so it's not going to be affected by this.
I just wanted to point out that I've had some good discussions on this one sentence. Only a person can love and be loved.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to your pet, you know, you think they love you, but they really don't.
That's they have just feelings affection. For you.
Yeah.
They're affectionate.
Yeah, they're affectionate. Yeah. And again, you know, if you make that love, then there's no such thing as personality. All there is self. You know, and God is just going to be a really, really fancy dog. Like you said, I mean, you know. Yeah. Yeah, that's why I said that. Right? See, just. Right. See, but just think about that. See, that's what they're saying. You know, where is it again? Therefore, did the better concepts of the divine personality have patiently to await the appearance of improved ideas of human personality? It's impossible for you to have any notion of God as just a really, really fancy dog if you think a dog has personality. And can you have, and the question is, can you have that thought without saying, oh, so you're saying dogs are worthless? They mean nothing. You know, that they're no different than a rock. It's like, no, I'm not saying that. Can we think about something except in dichotomies? You know, we're not setting up a dichotomy here. It's just you have to see things hierarchically. You are above a dog, and God is above you. That's just the way it is.
Your dog knows it. Maybe you should know it.
Yeah, maybe you should know it too. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I know. I know. You know. It's easy to kind of just sort of joke about this, but I mean, you have to stop and say, you know, actually, there's a lot of people who that's really what they're thinking. They may put it in really fancy language to mask that fact, but when you boil it down, that's the idea that's in play. And that is too small an idea to fit God into. God can't fit in an idea that small. Okay.
Ultimate universe reality cannot be grasped by mathematics, logic, or philosophy, only by personal experience and progressive conformity to the divine will of a personal God. Neither science, philosophy, nor theology can validate the personality of God. Only the personal experience of the faith sons of the Heavenly Father can effect the actual spiritual realization of the personality of God. The higher concepts of universe personality imply identity, self-consciousness, self-will, and possibility for self-revelation. And these characteristics further imply fellowship with other and equal personalities, such as exist in the personality associations of the paradise deities. And the absolute unity of these associations is so perfect that divinity becomes known by indivisibility, by oneness. The Lord God is one. Indivisibility of personality does not interfere with God's bestowing his spirit to live in the hearts of mortal men. Indivisibility of a human father's personality does not prevent the reproduction of mortal sons and daughters.
Okay, a couple little technical things. You know, there's a bunch of sort of, you know, just sort of direct appeal that, you know, you should, I'm sure you can recognize it in these paragraphs here. But let's make sure we have bring the specificity, the precision of recognition in here too. So the higher concepts of universe personality imply. So this is a little list. It's like, okay, if you're beginning to have some notion of what personality is different from self, if you can figure out what those four things are talking about. Okay, so identity. Like we pointed out, one of the fundamental aspects of what's going on with personality, because it's not a thing, you know, in a substance or an energy sense, that personality, that purposing has a point of identification. So that's a key aspect of understanding, you know, the personality is identifying with the self. You know, so I mean, that immediately is creating this separation between the two when you think about it that way. Personality is coming down and identifying with a self. And once it's done that, there is now that initial little measure of objective awareness where you can step back at least one step from that self and you can be conscious of the existence of that self. Self-consciousness. Okay. And now, let me actually put it in the way we normally, you know, we often do this thing with, you know, the self is over here to the left, you know, and the cosmos is over here to the right, you know, this left-hand, right-hand, you know, image that we often invoke with, the personal you, the heart here in the center. Okay. Think about, so once there's an identification, there's three things in play. There's the self-consciousness. You can look over here to the self. Oh, there's myself. It's a little bit juvenile. I should maybe work on that. You know, so that whole sublime thinking. Yeah, that's what I want to say. Yeah, the sublime thinking on that side. Okay, it's clamoring, but there's sublime thinking. You know, it's clamoring this direction, but it's sublime thinking this direction, you know, towards the self. Okay, and then just right here in the temple, in the heart, okay, there's self-will. I should do something about that, see? And the possibility for self-revelation. That's over here. There's the possibility that, you know, if you can muster the courage to turn, you know, let the adjuster have your back, the self will be okay, to turn over here, to trust, and consecrate your mind to the universal harmony that you can engage as you reach out to the cosmos. The extent to which you can synchronize with that, you bring that in. It becomes revealed, you know, the harmony of the cosmos becomes revealed within you, and you can apply it to the self. Okay, so that's, you know, that auto-revelation, sort of, you know, self-revelation, okay, is coming in from this side. So it's that same image that we've invoked so much. Self-consciousness, self-will, and the possibility of self-revelation. Yeah. Just because that is there doesn't mean immediately, boom, it starts flooding in and transforming you. Okay, that's why they said it that way. Okay. It's not automatic, but the possibility is there. There is an opening, a connection to the cosmos. And, you know, and if you can make this domain something that can actually synchronize with that so that it can flow in, it will flow in. There will be a revelation of universal harmony within you. And it'll reform the mind, yeah.
You mentioned that I should do. That's a purposing statement.
Right, right. See, you have a sense of purpose, self-will. And not only that, so you know that you can do something about that. The self, you know, just in and of itself, despairs. It's hopeless, you know. I can't do anything, you know, about this. You know, I'm a victim of, you know, of my environment. Blah, blah.
Stop, make it stop.
No. This knows that it can do something about that. This knows, you know, the person knows that it has a gift that transcends everything, potentially. There's no mountain too high that you can't overcome. Now, you may not be able to you may not be able to do it in this life, but you know with certitude you can overcome that. You will overcome that. One day you will overcome that. You know it. And because you know that with absolute certitude, you patiently take up the task of starting to reform that self to make it something that will overcome that, if not in this life, in the next.
You start to naturally start saying to yourself, instead of becoming discouraged, you say, you know what? I can do that. And you start saying that for more and more stuff. I can do that. You know, I know what's going on here. You know, it's just so different from how it used to be. You know, it's just like you just feel just totally helpless, and I gotta get some guru or somebody to tell me how to do it.
I just feel like,
or I need some chemist to fix it for me.
Take your opiate.
Yeah. Now, just one other little technical thing, you know, that we can appreciate, you know, and it was a lot of clarity. This whole, you know, you notice how they brought in oneness, you know, and even, you know, quoting there, the Lord God is one. You know, that oneness, you know, is here in the first source and center. Yeah, you have the infinite one. Okay, so think about that. Indivisibility of personality does not interfere with God's bestowing his spirit to live in the hearts of mortal men. Where is the thought adjuster coming from? Is it coming from this indivisible oneness here? No, it's coming from the infinite upholder. Okay? It can come from there, you know, at the same time that there's indivisibility, the oneness over here. Okay, and your personality, see, reflects that oneness.
Right.
It came from that reservoir.
They're opposite each other on the chart.
Okay, see, so just, you know, notice that little technicality and how, oh, wow, I could spend some time reflecting on that. And really, the more I reflect on that, the more I appreciate the difference of what's going on. So that's, notice the little things like that and spend some time advancing your understanding with the tools that we've developed here.
This concept of indivisibility in association with the concept of unity implies transcendence of both time and space by the ultimacy of deity. Therefore, neither space nor time can be absolute or infinite. The first source and center is that infinity who unqualifiedly transcends all mind, all matter, and all spirit. The fact of the Paradise Trinity is The fact of the Paradise Trinity in no manner violates the truth of the divine unity. The three personalities of Paradise Deity are in all universe reality reactions and in all creature relations as one. Neither does the existence of these three eternal persons violate the truth of the indivisibility of deity. I am fully aware that I have at my command no language adequate to make clear to the mortal mind how these universe problems appear to us. But you should not become discouraged. Not all of these things are wholly clear to even the high personalities belonging to my group of paradise beings. Ever bear in mind that these profound truths pertaining to deity will increasingly clarify as your minds become progressively spiritualized during the successive epochs of the long mortal ascent to paradise.
Long. Emphasis on the long. Before we read that last, you know, wonderful little footnote there.
Long and winding road.
They're alluding to some, you know, fairly advanced things. I don't want to go into a lot of detail, but that whole kind of mysterious second to last paragraph there, this concept of indivisibility in association with the concept of unity implies transcendence of both time and space by the ultimacy of deity, let me give you a little taste of what they're pointing to there, that when we talked about the Supreme Being, we were reflecting on the parallel between what you're moving toward with the full realization of the Supreme Being and how that parallels notions that we talk about with the Father. We talk about, you know, he freed himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity. And we recognize that there was a whole hierarchy then of that phenomenon, and that down, you know, relative to the finite, he, the Supreme Being, will eventually free himself from the fetters of unqualified supremacy. There will be this transcendence of both time and space by the ultimacy of deity. So just indivisibility, you know, that individual that finally transcends is the Supreme One. Okay, that oneness that they just brought up. Yeah, that transcendent fact is the Supreme One. And so you have this oneness. You know, so from a top-down view, that oneness, see, that's transcendent is this encompassing of the finite. But there's unity down within the finite. So that's what they're you know, we remember when we talked about all of the details of total deity. We went through that paper and we were going through deity and reality. We pointed out how they were giving you the initial sense when you're thinking about the I am and the infinite, how they were pointing to, on the one side you can think of the oneness aspect of it, on the other side you can think of the unity aspect, and that there was going to be a separation, that total will was going to separate from total deity, that oneness was going to separate from unity. I mean, all that really advanced recognition of how this all fits together is kind of behind or between the lines of what they're saying there.
It's interesting that that went right before he had nothing at his command.
Like we've pointed out, none of the revelators try to lay out all this stuff. They give you suggestions and the basic anchor points. And then if you begin to put it together using your recognition that transcends words that even they can pen, you'll begin to get it. But you're going to have to take delight in cultivating the process of following the leads that they've given you. And, you know, and then another thing they're bringing in, you know, is that differential between the first source and center and the Paradise Trinity. I don't want to go into all the details there, but again, there's, you know, when we talked about the universal one of infinity and the two sides of that, the one side is the first center and the other side is the Paradise Trinity, you know, or in other words, on one side you have the first source and center and the other side you have the Paradise Trinity, and one is the origin and foundation of the Father and the other is the origin and foundation of the Mother. One is God as transcendence, one is God as immanence. Mm-hmm. See, all this, that's all this oneness, unity, see, the, all that's in play there. So for the advanced reader, they're throwing all these little things to kind of get your mind sparking on thinking about all of that greater picture, how that all hangs together. But at the very least, though, you can kind of take it at a little more face value. With that whole bit of, you know, the moment that you think of the Paradise Trinity as a fourth fact, and it's you know, undivided deity. It's indivisible deity. You know, they're trying to get you to think, you know, even though you have that, you can still divide out the four persons and have the Paradise Trinity, what's left, you know, and that sort of top-down viewpoint. Or, you know, even, you know, if you have the three persons, the fact that they give rise to that super additive consequence doesn't mean that they somehow get absorbed into it and cease to be separate. So whether you look at it top down or bottom up, that's what they're trying to get at. There's nothing illogical about the two simultaneously existing. Now, technically how that gets into a little bit more advanced to appreciate. You know, here they're, you know, for the new reader, they're trying to just state, take that for a given. You know, you can have a Paradise Trinity and not lose the three persons. You know, one is not preventing the fact of the other, either way. All right, so then the Divine Counselor gives his famous little epilogue here.
Presented by a Divine Counselor, a member of a group of celestial personalities assigned by the Ancients of Days on Uversa, the headquarters of the seventh superuniverse, to supervise those portions of this forthcoming revelation which have to do with affairs beyond the borders of the local universe of Nebadon. I am commissioned to sponsor those papers portraying the nature and attributes of God because I represent the highest source of information available for such a purpose on any inhabited world. I have served as a divine counselor in all seven of the super universes and have long resided at the paradise center of all things. Many times have I enjoyed the supreme pleasure of a sojourn in the immediate personal presence of the Universal Father. I portray the reality and truth of the Father's nature and attributes with unchallengeable authority. I know whereof I speak.
Okay.
But
now think about how the discussion went tonight and tie it to that last thing. I portray the reality and truth of the Father's nature and attributes with unchallengeable authority. I know whereof I speak. These statements that he's made about personality. He's saying, now, I know that for many of you, it's either going to be, huh? Or it's going to be, wait a minute, I don't think that quite jives with the way I've always liked to think about personality.
That's true.
He knows that's, you know, he's going to get that kind of response. So he, you know, he plays his authority card. Do you have the recognition up to this point to know that he knows whereof he speaks? Do you know that? Or do you just know that there's a sentence that says that? Do you know that he does know? And hence, you know that you should take up the challenge to reform your consciousness so that you understand what he just told you about the personality of God and of yourself. Think about why this statement is here and not somewhere else. And why didn't he put it up front or something? Why did he put it here? It's in the wake of giving you, the one thing that is so sorely lacking in human understanding, that fact of personality. If we had the fact of personality in our recognition, you know, universally, that would go so far to transforming our relationship with one another.
I know that no human being has ever spoken to me that way.
Yeah. You know, I mean, not only, you know, but giving you a little back, I mean, you know, those who've thought about this, you know, for him to have served in all seven super universes, and when he says long resided, you know he's talking about trillions and trillions and countless trillions of years.
Yeah. And he's still not too sure how to put it.
trillions and trillions of years. Okay? And he's speaking to you in the first person.
How am I going to know, Chris?
How you're going to know is you're going to take the light and cultivating. The more you know, the more when you try to read this to yourself, you weep. Right?
You know,
this is one of the most powerful, or you reject it.
Right.
You know, you experience this like those who lived 2,000 years ago experienced Jesus. They either wept at the majesty or they rejected him wholeheartedly. He's trying to draw the line. Okay, it's time for you to choose. It's time for you to use that personality and choose. Is this a revelation or bunk? Okay, and if you can't choose here, stop reading. Okay, don't keep reading and then you know badger me.
Right.
No, I don't think this is a revelation. Okay, if you don't think it's a revelation, you should have stopped right here. You know, with his challenge that you would have found completely, you know, ridiculous, and you would have burned the stupid thing. Right. Okay, okay. So you know. At some point, you know, this needs to be a bifurcation. You know, at some point it gets just a little bit tedious. Okay. All right.
Not only did you reject it, but you're ready to stumble your fellows.
Not to belabor that negative side. I mean, you know where I am. I'm a lover of that statement. You know, you know, and that's what I'm about, you know, and so that's, you know, what you see is what you get. I know that he portrays it with unchallengeable authority. I know that I can take the book directly and use it. You know, there's nothing metaphorical about this. I can transform every single thing within me with this revelation. And I just stand in awe of how incredibly cool the fact is that is here. I'm holding a book written by him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Someone with unchallengeable authority has written a book for me.
How much time did he spend on paradise?
Yeah. I mean, how insanely incredible is that? I mean, you happen to be born when you could read a book that was written by someone with unchallengeable authority.
You know, this is a question that came up in our church. It's like, where now is our authority? That is the burning question.
Mm-hmm.
And I have an authority. But the oddity of, it's hard to put myself in the place of not...
Mm-hmm.
Of having that an open question.
Mm-hmm. And we all know we're designed by the life carriers to seek authority, you know, because they're supposed to be authority figures that we seek out. Planetary Prince and his staff, Adam and Eve, and we don't have those. So, yeah, where is our authority? Okay. And now not only is it inside of us, it's outside of us. This is authoritative. The authoritative elimination of error right here in your lap. All right, let's take a moment and reflect on that.